So I'm born in Denmark. I came to Canada about 40 years ago and did my undergraduate work in London, Ontario, at the University of Western Ontario. Moved to the States and did my graduate work and postdoctoral work in respectively California and New York and St. Louis. And then I came back to Western and I worked as a faculty member there for 24 years. Also took on some administrative duties, but I'm a chemist. Took my degree as a physical chemist, but my research has always been overlapping between chemistry and biology. And then 4 years ago, I got attracted to this position.
Were you with the National Research Council before that?
No, I was with the University of Western Ontario. I was the Vice President of Research at the university. And this looked like a really interesting opportunity, in particular because it is a partnership between the university and the NRC.
Where does being a professor of chemistry and working with biology get mixed up with nanotechnology?
Well, that's an interesting question, of course, but nanotechnology is a area of convergence focused on the scale, the metric scale of nanometers, but is also a convergence of the physical sciences with the biological sciences. And in our work, what we qualify in the sense as nanotechnology is that we worked a lot with a membrane system, which is very thin and has interesting physical properties as a consequence of that. And also we use many of the tools that are the trade of the nanotechnology community in general, atomic force microscopy tools and other high-resolution tools that allow us to look at biological systems at the molecular level.
As Director General, do you get to continue any research on your own?
I do, and in part because I have a joint position with the university, so I have the opportunity to have grants from National Science and Engineering Research Council, as well as the CIHR, the Canadian Institute of Health Research. So I've carried on with some postdoctoral research fellows at the university here.
Tell me a bit about your research then. What is it that you're doing now?
Well, I'm working on basically two major thrusts. One has been a long-standing interest in understanding how proteins and lipids interact in a membrane system of a cell, and that has to do with how cells communicate with each other. How does one cell tell a neighboring cell that it's there and maybe make the other one stop growing, for example, in growth control? So understanding that interaction on the surfaces of cells is something we've been interested in for a number of years. And the other area we've been working on for the last decade or so has to do with the structure and the organizations of very thin films in the lung. It's called a surfactant film, which causes lungs to stay open for air and allow for exchange of oxygen across into the cell systems in the lung. And failure of that film leads to complications in lung disease. So we've tried to understand the properties of that film, both from a composition point of view and a structure point of view.
Where would nanoscience help improve that research?
So for us, it's primarily using the tools that allow us to look at very high resolution, look at molecular level detail, and understand the structural organization of these systems. So it's the tools, as I said before, atomic force microscopy, and also in many cases looking at optical microscopy. So it's in a sense, it's the use of the tools from the nanoscience community in the biological systems, the way we work with it. There is another point to that, which we don't take so much advantage of, but others do, and that is to learn from the biological systems and understand them well enough that you can now design new nanotechnologies based on the biological insights.
As Director General of the Nanotechnology Institute, what is it that you actually have to do on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, as you just, when you came in, you saw me sign a lot of papers, so that's certainly one of the aspects of it. But I guess broader context, my role is to try to position the Institute both within the University of Alberta, within the National Research Council, and within the Alberta government as an organization that can provide foundational research that in turn will lead to new applications of nanotechnology. So it's my job to represent the Institute nationally and internationally, to try to convey to the stakeholders the value of what we're doing and convince them that we are, in fact, performing at a good level and are internationally competitive. And then, of course, there is the supervision, if you will, or guidance of the researchers within the organization, trying to give them some strategic objectives and try to get them to collaborate within the organization.
Now, you have a wonderful building here on the University of Alberta campus. What's special about it?
Well, there are several things that are special. It is designed to optimize interaction of people from different disciplines. So if you look through the design of the building, we have created it so that the chemistry labs are next to the biology labs, which are next to the engineering labs, so that you have a natural flow of people who will interact with each other. You'll also see that the seating arrangements are fairly open space, so that there are lots of opportunity for people to talk to each other across the different disciplines. So it's almost like a social engineering environment from that point of view. But on top of that, it's also designed to house some very specialized types of equipment, things that are both sensitive from the point of view of vibration and acoustics and electromagnetic radiation. So we've tried to design a building that can accommodate those pieces of equipment in the best possible way. And I guess the final way is that it is sitting in a part of the university campus which is in close proximity to both the sciences and the engineering faculties that the institute needs to interact with. So there is an easy access and easy communication across the different disciplines.
The thing I find quite fascinating is the interdisciplinary approach. So many people I interview in different areas of science all seem to have a connection to the nanotechnology research that's going on. Why is that happening? Why is that important?
I think there are two sides to that. One is, as I said before, nanotechnology is a science, if you will, or an area where we see a convergence of ideas from different disciplines coming to fruition. So it's a natural draw for people to come and explore this. But in a more fundamental way, it's because in the last century, in a broad sense, but in the last 25 years in particular, we have come to learn to understand what happens at the molecular level and how to both understand it better, manipulate it in various ways, learn from it and draw from it and design new things. And that's true in physics, it's true in chemistry, it's true in biology, that we've come together and get a better understanding. And that in turn means that there's a common objective that we often see. And it's that common objective that's driving people together. And then beginning to understand that, hey, I'm a chemist, but I can work with an engineer and get a better insight into how we can not only understand what's going on, but maybe even make it more practical and apply it in various ways. So it's those kind of synergies that are coming quite naturally, and it's quite exciting, actually.
What are some of the projects that are on the go here at NINT?
So we have decided to try to develop applications in four major areas, and they're typical ones that everybody's concerned about. One is in energy-related areas, particularly in alternative energies. So we have some projects associated with trying to make better materials for solar absorption and solar cells. We have some projects working on fuel cell design and catalysts and hydrogen storage associated with that. So that's trying to look to the future for different types of energy sources. We also have an area of interest in general in the medical and health related areas, or the biotechnology area, if you will. And that has to do then with projects, some of them like mine, where we're trying to understand the biological systems, others where we're trying to manipulate biological systems or learn from biological systems to create new things. So one of the examples is that people have learned from biological structures how they assemble and what the forces are that cause molecules to assemble in particular ways. So we will use that insight to create other kinds of molecules that will assemble in a similar fashion. And then we learn to control how to do that and then create new structures, new materials. The third area that we have a significant amount of work in is related to broadly the information communications technology sector. And in that area, we focused on the molecular electronics side, meaning that we're trying to do what our current electronics is doing, but using molecules rather than larger structures. Ultimately, the purpose there is to reduce the size and perhaps create new kinds of structures that can do the same kind of computational machinery that we have now, but much smaller, less energy required, and therefore more effective. And the fourth area is an area that we're slowly beginning to think about, and that is aligning it with the interests of the province in particular, but also the country more broadly, in trying to work on what they call bioindustries, which is related to the agricultural and forestry sectors, and trying to understand how one might be able to get new biomaterials, new materials that come from a biological source and a carbon source other than the petrochemical one, and see if we can substitute plastics of today with another kind of material with similar or better properties. That's an area we're just starting to work with and thinking about how we can get involved in that. And in connection with many of these fields, we have a fairly strong program on sensor development, particularly using very fine nanomechanical structures. And finally, we have underpinning all of this programs that relate to theory and modeling and to instrument development.
Nanoscience is definitely new, and nanotechnology is just starting to make its way as a term into people's everyday language. But are there any applications at this point? Have we actually done anything that has been commercialized at this point?
Absolutely. We haven't ourselves, if you will, as an institute yet, but certainly there are products in the market today that uses various types of nanotechnology. We think about nanotechnology development in sort of three phases. The first one is what already exists, and in many respects there are, and we can call them mundane applications, such as using nanoparticles in paint to get a stronger luster. There are a number of products that are cosmetic products which use nanoparticles of various types to, again, get a sheen or something like that. There is a significant number of products that are claiming to be antimicrobial based on silver nanoparticles materials in socks or in dressings and, in some cases, in containers, cookware, and so on. So there's officially people in the United States, an organization that keep track of it called the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, and they argue there's in the order of 700 products on the market today, which is characterized as nano-enabled products. So that's the first phase, and we're in that, and we're certainly seeing some development in that. And I think this was an estimate that probably about, I think the number is right, about $50 billion globally now is in the economy based on that. Then we look to the next sort of 5 to 10 years, and we'll look at nanotechnology invading our current product lines. So your cell phone will become better, your product lines that you are currently buying for cameras, whatever it might be, are going to get better because we'll put new technology into that, and we'll see that become just a common part of what we do. This is a replacement type of technology, if you will. And that'll happen. There's no question about that. It's already beginning to happen. And for example, we have seen developments in what's called the giant magnetoresistant devices that are going into memory structures for computers. And that was an invention about 20 years ago. So we're seeing this happening as well. The third phase, which is for many of the scientists most exciting, is the possibility of seeing nanotechnology being transformational. That means we're looking to see creating new products that we haven't even thought about today, creating new kinds of structures, materials that just are smart, respond to the environment, and do things that we are just dreaming about in a certain sense from a science fiction point of view, but are still going to be happening, I'm sure. And that's where a lot of our science is not aimed specifically at that, but that's where a lot of us are thinking that it would be really interesting to have some of that transformational type of science coming out of this institute. So it is this blend of being able to look to the short-term future with technologies that might come into current product lines, and then the longer term of creating a whole new kind of economy based on new kinds of products.
What has come out of NINT so far, out of your scientific research with the different researchers here?
We have no specific commercial outcome at this point. We've been in existence in full-fledged form for about 2 years now. We moved into the building in June of 2006. Prior to that, we were sort of slowly ramping up and building the building and hiring people and whatnot. So much of the credit we can claim now is on the backs of people who come with experience into the Institute. So we've recruited people, many of them senior, who have had a long-standing background and expertise. And what we're hoping to do is coalesce and gel some of that into new technologies. So we can't claim to have anything on the market today that comes out of this. But we have started to see some reports of inventions, patent applications, and we have at least one successful patent product now, which is related to a very, very thin tip that can potentially be used in electron microscopes for better tools and perhaps in other applications as well. So we're seeing a bit of this foundational science all of a sudden coming out and saying, hey, I needed to make this better tip, and all of a sudden, oops, that's very good. Maybe we can use it for something. So that's a little bit of the serendipity in the work. We are starting to see some reports of invention that are primarily right now sort of related to a lot of the molecular electronics and to some of the self-assembly activities that we have. But it is still going to be a few years before we can see a NINT label on a product in commerce, I think.
Who are some of the research leaders that have come here? I'm thinking of like Michael Brett is here and Dr. Robert Wilco.
Yes, so we have defined the Institute in around 23 people we call the principal investigators or principal scientists. Of those 23, 18 are new to Edmonton because of the Institute. And they come in, if you will, all flavors and all sizes. Some are senior scientists. So Michael Brett was at the University of Alberta, was recruited into the Institute. Bob Wolko was at the NRC in Ottawa and came to Alberta as a consequence of the Institute being created. We recruited successfully a senior scientist from Ohio State, Rick McCreary, in the molecular electronics area. Early on, before I came, there was a recruiting of two mid-career people from Purdue, there's Gillian Buryak and Hisham Finneri, and we have also recruited some early career people from various parts, people who have been in the academic positions in the United States or other parts of Canada, so in the early first five years or so. People such as Stephen Evoy from electrical engineer from from Pennsylvania. There are some younger people. The first director general here did some very interesting things. He created some positions of very young people who were just starting out their careers, and we basically hired them and then seconded them to go to work in other institutions because we didn't have the lab space here. So we sent people to MIT, to Cornell, to Stanford, and to Caltech, and they learned some tools, and then we repatriate them back here, and now they're starting their own careers on the basis of what they learned there. So there's been sort of a blend of people in the younger and the more senior ranks.
Now, this is called the National Institute for Nanotechnology. So being at the University of Alberta, how do you incorporate nano research that's going on at other institutions across the country?
So at the moment, we haven't tried to become the sort of force of driving activities across the country. What we've focused a lot on is to create a unique partnership, and therefore it has been very much focused on establishing our relationship between the National Research Council and the University of Alberta in the first place. We are now coming to the point where our national outreach is beginning, and we're trying to look at that in a couple of different ways. One is as a center where people might want to come and work, both because we have good people and because we have good facilities. So they might be attractive for people at other institutions to come here and spend some time because they can do some work they might not otherwise be able to do. But the other is also trying to create some key alliances with the researchers in place to create collaborations that might be meaningful. And the difficulty for an institution in general is to force marriages is very difficult, and so you have to rely on scientists finding a natural ally to collaborate with and to work with. And so you have to sort of strategically try to find both the right matches and the right institutional relationships. So that's what we're beginning to try to do now. We started by looking within the NRC as well, because the National Research Council has 17 institutes across the country, and we have started a program that we call the NRC Nano Program, which has been landing at this place for implementation, which is a program that, on the one hand, tries to leverage all of the expertise across the NRC, tries to build bridges from the NRC into the university community through some funding programs in collaboration with NSERC, in fact, and also tries to coordinate and provide sort of a national picture of what's going on within the National Research Council. And early on, I think one of the roles we will try to take on is to provide the conduit of information so that there is some place where we assemble information about what's happening more broadly in Canada. So that's the type of activity we start engaging in now. It's clear that there are many universities in Canada who do excellent work in this area, and we're not trying to sort of take them over or by any way trying to threaten their ability to do what they want to do. We're not trying to necessarily influence their activities in a specific way, but we would like to, I think, help them, if there is a need for it, to get more of a national coherence and maybe be able to, at the international level, also portray Canada as a country that is, in fact, doing really good work across the whole set of sectors.
Why would you want to be a leader in the world? Why not just follow what other people are doing and pick up on their research afterwards?
I think it's a question of having a competitive edge ultimately, you can always ask the question, why do you do homegrown science in general? And it's true of nanotechnology as well. And if you think about Canada as a country and its place in the world, we, roughly speaking, correspond to about 2% of the global GNP, gross national product, or GDP, whatever the terminology is. But we represent about 4% of the knowledge generation. So we have an edge. We have a knowledge edge relative to our size of economy. And that extra knowledge generation allows us to take advantage of the 96% of the knowledge created around the world and bring it to Canada. But it also allows us to create and develop new technologies here that hopefully will lead to business development as well. So I think it's important that we are at the leading edge, both in terms of understanding what's going on and in terms of creating new concepts and be part of the community in the world that is creating the next generation of technologies and new economy, if you will. Because otherwise we can't do that well and train at the same time the people that needs to be part of that picture. And I think if you look at a place like Alberta, the Alberta government has put a great value in trying to create the next generation technologists as well, people who understand nanotechnology in particular from a scientific point of view and can use that when they go into business. Training of people is important. You can't do that unless you have really good facilities to do it in and have good science around it. So it's a combination of different things. So I think we have a competitive edge in our brains, more so than in our brawn, if you will, as a country, because we don't have that many people, so we can't compete in labor rates, but we can, I think, compete at the intellectual level.
NINT ended up in Alberta as opposed to any other province in Canada. So what is it that gave Alberta the edge?
I wasn't around at the time, but I'm sure there's many versions of the story, but my interpretation is really that it's based on two fundamental things. One was that the University of Alberta in its own right had invested significantly, had a core strength in this area. They had created the nanofabrication facility in the engineering faculty. They had people like Mike Brett, Jed Harris, and others who were embroiled in this new field and saw the opportunity in general. So the U of A was very well positioned to accept and expand on this. And the leadership of the university at the time saw the opportunity of becoming strategically very strong in this area. And that was coupled, I believe, with the fact that the government of Alberta was interested in co-investing. And so it was the combination of the university being prepared, the government ready to take a specific direct action, and then negotiations with the National Research Council to make that happen. And I guess that at the time as well, there was the sort of the political underpinnings that there was no NRC presence in a significant way in the province, and so that was seen as a driving force for the NRC as well. So I think it was a number of different activities, and the field in part was because the university and the community here was really ready for that. And there was the sense that this is an area in which 20, 30, 40 years from now, we could develop a new economy. And an economy that's based not only on creating new things, but also enhancing the current economic base. So there is expectations that nanotechnology will help in the energy field and therefore transform that, maybe creating catalysts that will do better upgrading, more efficient extraction of oil. There may be technologies that can be used in the agriculture and forestry sector to help that stay vibrant and contribute to the economy here. And then creating that new medical technology type of environment that doesn't exist here now but might be an interesting new frontier for the province.
Well, you mentioned energy as an area of research focus. Could you perhaps describe in more detail one or two of the projects that are being worked on right now?
I always have this problem that I can't describe too much detail because some of it is still proprietary in various ways. But within the university, there is an organization called COSI, a Center for Oil Sands Innovation, which is funded in part by Imperial and in part by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. And they are concerned themselves a lot with understanding the current extraction and upgrading procedures that are happening in the oil sands development and try to increase the efficiency, the effectiveness, and trying to decrease the side effects of use of a lot of water and so on. So there's a number of different engineering type projects and science type of projects associated with that. As an institute, we have some association with that, but it's not our major focus. In the energy sector, we are trying to look for opportunities that are based on the expertise we have, but also puts us in maybe a very good competitive position because we can combine some sciences. And we have some interest in looking at, as I said before, better structural materials for solar cells. And Mike Brett and Julian Burek are working jointly, so we have an inorganic-based chemist who can do very interesting material modifications, and an engineer who can create very interesting structured materials. And by combining their expertise, they think they have an edge in trying to create new kind of materials that will do a better job, improve the efficiency of capture of light and conversion into electricity. So that's an example of the type of rather focused effort we're trying to get in there that builds on prior understanding of those individuals and then combining it. Another example is hydrogen storage, where we have a young material scientist, David Midland, who understands material properties really well and is looking to modify the materials so that they can absorb hydrogen and store the hydrogen as a energy battery, if you will, and then release it fairly effectively. And there's some really interesting challenges in that he believes he has some interesting approaches to. So that's another example of a niche area of energy that we believe will be important, particularly for Canada, because hydrogen is coupled with fuel cells, and Canada has a strong effort in general in fuel cells and have some companies that are in this area as well. So it feeds into a strength for the country, if you will.
You also have a researcher on staff who deals with ethics and the social side of things.
That's right.
Why is that necessary? What's the concern about ethics?
It's a combination of concerns. There's a concern, ethics is one side of it, but it's also the public acceptance of the technologies that we are moving forward with and the understanding the potential impact that these technologies can have in society. So it's a broader thing than just the ethics side, if you will. We don't, at this point at least, see the same ethical conflicts that we saw in the biotechnology era, but we're learning from that. And what we have an opportunity to do here is before we see a wholesale implementation of nanotechnologies within the broader society, we have a chance to, in advance, look at some of the issues that might arise. So that's what we're trying to do. So Laurie Shimada, who's involved in this, has been in very interested in understanding what is the public view of nanotechnology, what is their level of acceptance of this type of technology within their world, do they see it as a threat or as an excitement, when we are moving forward, what kind of regulatory processes are necessary to keep the public happy and to keep our society safe? Are there going to be special impact of this new kinds of technology? And it comes in part because we know that one of the exciting sides of nanotechnology is that we create materials with new properties, and the properties are specifically new because of the size of the particles. So it's a size-dependent phenomenon. If we know that we're creating new properties and new materials, then we also should look at what do the new materials do, whether they do, is a medical impact, environmental impact, or whatever it could be. So it behooves us to have these questions up front and center and be proactive about potential issues rather than being reactive after we recognize something happens. So it's for us, Laurie is providing a window to that world and keeping us informed about what's going on in the world, plus she's contributing to the views of others in this area. She's been in part involved in providing reports for Health Canada, for Environment Canada, and also been actively engaged in trying to get our science community to understand what the concerns are, what the concerns are really legitimate, and which ones we really should be paying attention to. So it's that broader context that's important. We call it nanotechnology, economic, environmental, ethical, legal, and social issues as a broader palette. And in addition to Laurie, we also have association with Michael Lounsbury, who's a business professor. And his interest is trying to understand the economic side of this picture and understand how companies grow within a nanotechnology environment. What is it that makes them successful? And what features do we have to look at? Are they different than biotechnology companies, as startup companies? Do they have different types of concerns? So we're trying to understand the environment that makes it possible. So in Alberta, for example, we know that a nanotechnology company will not be able to spend $50 million on infrastructure. So having access to facilities like ours is potentially important for a small company. Likewise, as they move along the technology development into the product development, they need facilities in the vicinity that can do that. So the province has funded something called ACAMP to help solve the product development side of it rather than the technology development side. So if you then start looking at the whole picture and say you can now create a environment or ecosystem where it becomes easy for a small company to get the assistance they need, from the science to the technology to the product, then we have a stream where we can make companies successful. So that whole look of it is part of what Michael does.
What's unique about NINT?
There are, apart from the fact that we have outstanding scientists and outstanding research facilities, I think there's a unique model for interaction going on here as well. We have tried to create a hybrid institute in some sense. The National Research Council and the University of Alberta at this point are working very tightly to create an environment where on the one end of a research bench you have the creative juices of a young graduate student developing new science and new ideas, and at the other end of the bench you have the seasoned technical officer or research officer of a National Research Council that can help take that set of ideas and bring them closer to a technology. So we're trying to bridge some of the gaps of idea flow into technology development. And by having a hybrid type of institute, we can cross-appoint people from the university to the NRC and give them all the privileges of the NRC, and we can cross-appoint people from the NRC to the university and give them all the privileges of the university environment. And that creates then a group of people who have the best of both worlds. And then we then try to milk that in a sense and create this sense of having a very high standard of excellence, but also put some strategic objectives into the play so that it's not just going whichever way you want, but you go in certain directions as an organization. And that the sort of a milieu that is, I think, quite different from many others.
When you look into the future, what is it that excites you about the potential for nanoscience and nanotechnology?
I guess, on the one hand, the very pragmatic view that it's going to happen no matter what, so we better do it well, and we can contribute to that in some way or another. But I think there's also really the sort of almost fascination of being able to work in a world that you can't see. I sometimes compare it to people's fascination with astrophysics, where you need tools that are so that you can see the stars far, far away, and you get fascinated by the sort of unknown, in a sense. And here we need special tools to work with something that's so small that we can barely see it. And that, I think, is exciting. The ability to learn from nature and use nature in a constructive and a planned way is something that's really quite fascinating, so that we can actually start to really design new types of constructs, of new types of materials that'll just do different things. That's just exciting, I think.
Thank you very much, Nils.
You're quite welcome.